everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you with the Positive Mind. Here in the studio with some favorite people. Dr. Kent Robert Shaw is with us. Linda Vanella, Booker Irvin Jr. Bringing new ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. And it dawns to me, it comes to me that we're going to be celebrating Thanksgiving soon, which is a very mixed holiday for many people, especially BAI audience, knowing how it led to so much abuse of our native population. However, there is something about Thanksgiving that's fascinating, which was that it goes back 388 years to the arrival of the Pilgrims in Massachusetts. And watch this. The Pilgrims were among a number of sects called Puritans. And today, we're going to be talking about sexual obsessiveness. Sexual obsessiveness. You know anybody sexually obsessed? Are you sexually obsessed? We're going to talk about it, not from just a negative point of view. Talk about the good of it, too. Sexual obsessiveness. Well, why do I bring this up at Thanksgiving? Do you think people have obsessions about turkeys? No, the Puritans came to America essentially because they thought that England had become too bawdy, too dirty, too sexual. So the Puritans were among the first sexually obsessed people to come to America. Now, how were they obsessed? They were obsessed with the avoidance of sex. And it was the idea that the Puritans suffered from religious persecution in England. That's probably a myth. What they suffered from was unease because there was so much temptation. You know, it's like living in Manhattan and trying to keep your eyes over off what's happening in Manhattan. It's just too much temptation. And it's so difficult. And for some, the Puritans decided we're going to get away from all this temptation. We're going to go to a new country. So various Puritan colonies were established in America, colonies with dictatorial repression of daily life, mostly of anything sexual. They didn't even enjoy marital sex. It's like, don't enjoy it, just do it. If you got to do it, make babies and get out of it. In Nathaniel Hawthorne's A Scarlet Letter talks about the miseries of an adulterous couple in Puritan community. Now, our custom is for three or four generations of family to sit down at a Thanksgiving dinner with hardly a memory of what the Pilgrims and other Puritans were all about, with sexual obsession. So Thanksgiving is a sexual holiday. Hey, that changes the thing a little bit, doesn't it? Even if you're having tofu. Linda, what do you think?
I really think it's quite interesting to look at that because, you know, while we think about the Pilgrims and we kind of can think about puritanical wardrobe, as women would always have high neck blouses and whatever, but when we get to really understand that they were actually in search of living in a place where they can avoid sexuality, where they could live without it, they felt that it was... really wrong, they moralized, and so therefore you wonder how even procreation came about, because it was something that was only reserved to procreate, and even then it was really judged harshly. So, and of course criminalized.
You better not enjoy it.
Yeah, you couldn't enjoy it. And even outside of marriage, they put people to death. So that was rather interesting.
Now, it didn't just start with the Puritans, yeah. Because it really started, had its roots in the Judeo-Christian, which kept moving more and more towards sexual repression.
Exactly.
And then all of a sudden, the Church of England said, nah, we're going to have a party. And that's where it all kind of went downhill again, because they said, no, get us back to that old way. But even the old way wasn't as puritanical as the Puritans, and the Puritans would kill people who are pagans. Just say, I would destroy anybody who doesn't do it my way. This is Armand DeMille with you. So the question becomes, is sex inherently evil? Is the sex act an abomination and a sin? If so, are women morally inferior and sources of temptation? Therefore, should they be wrapped up and put away, you know? Or as one of the prayers I know begin in a formal religion, thank God I'm not a woman. You know, is that the way it is? So much for the mechanics of Darwinian sexual selection. From a biological point, it's amazing we didn't go extinct. But it's no wonder that all the women who were driven into madness and incompatibility. I mean, what was a witch? Kent, come on in on this one. You remember, you know, the witches of Salem?
Sure.
Right? What was their biggest crime? What did they really do? They drove men to madness, and what did they do? What were they?
Well, being sexually seductive, making men have lustful thoughts that were sinful and bad and wrong was part of what made them evil. So is the seductiveness of women, partly the spells they would cast and the like, but related to stirring up these very uncomfortable and what puritanical society thought was, you know, sinful thoughts or behaviors. But even the thoughts were thought to be sinful, hence the famous lusting in your heart, meaning that even having the thoughts at that time would be something that you couldn't do.
So therefore, I want you all at Thanksgiving, when you sit down with your family in whatever form you do it, let's talk about sex, right? Whoever did that at a Thanksgiving dinner. Never heard that conversation. Hey, since we're here celebrating sex in some form, let's talk about it. Well, let's talk about sex. Let's talk about a thing called sexual obsessiveness. That means can't get it off my mind. Can't get it, meaning the it. Meaning I can't stop thinking about sex in one form or another, even if I try. That's when it gets defined as an obsession, I think, Kent. Is that accurate?
Yeah, something that occupies the mind quite a lot, for sure. You know, something that you think about, something that's, that you desire and want, is certainly would be just an obsession, in a neutral way of defining obsession.
And then when is that obsession considered you're a psychiatrist. When is it considered a problem? When it interferes.
When it interferes, you know, with hopefully no judgment or morality associated to sexuality on a purely scientific basis. It's only when the obsessive thoughts about sex cause some kind of harm to the person, their jobs, their relationships, their social relationships. It's causing some pain or destructiveness.
So, what kinds of sexual obsessiveness are there? I mean, what do we have?
Well, I think when you're saying, you know, the audience think about sex, I mean, everybody thinks about sex all the time. And
no, not everybody. Well, I know some older folk who say, I'm done thinking about it.
That's true. But I think at least studies would show that a lot of people's daydreaming and a lot of people's free time, certainly when they're younger, the thoughts drift to some realm of sexuality. And as we know with the computers and the like, that we know that a great deal of the internet is devoted to sexual images and sexual, pursuit of some sort of sexual satisfaction.
Well, it's kind of interesting you say that, because you're right. I mean, they say that about 90% of a computer usage is directed towards feeding sexual desire in some form or other. Well, that's very interesting. Let's take the judgment of pornography out of there. Let's throw out all the judgments. And you think about this and you say, wait a minute. If it 90% want this, where are we doing judging it? Are we the Puritans who are saying, you know, shut down the sites, don't have the sites, don't do this, and we're still trying to control it? Do we really believe, if we allow it to be, that we're going to encourage it and it's going to become more? Well, that hasn't worked very well. You know, permissiveness was fabulous during the 60s and 70s, and then there was repression, then there was AIDS and further repression, and now there's repression turned into different forms of self-satisfaction, which becomes the new sexual obsession. But it seems that people just got to have it. what makes it happen? Why do one people have it and another don't? Is it poor upbringing? Is it that your mother didn't let you play with your dolls that makes you think about sex all the time? Or is it something chemically in the brain that makes it work so that you just can't get free? Armando Milhi with you with The Positive Mind, Linda Vanilla, Kent Robert Shaw. Kent, is there any physiological part to this? Because I know part of treatment could be physiological as well as behavioral. What's the physiological components of a sexual obsession?
Well, we know that there are different hormones, things that are made by the body, the various glands of the body, and that there are different neurotransmitters, the chemicals that the brain uses to talk to different brain cells are involved. Certainly, going back to glands, testosterone, estrogen are very important components to sex drive and libido, that the endocrine system, particularly testosterone in men, testosterone as well with women, are very important factors that regulate and sort of call the need to have sexual satisfaction, sexual images, and the like. And certainly the brain, the pleasure center of the brain, one I've talked about in past shows about various substances and the like, but the pleasure center of the brain, called the nucleus accumbens, but it doesn't make a difference what it's called, we know that area of the brain gets lit up and turned on during sexual satisfaction. So we know that it's fairly hardwired, as if anyone doesn't know this, as a very euphoric, pleasurable activity.
Nuclear accumbens?
The nucleus accumbens, yes.
Nucleus, and why isn't a t-shirt made with that word on it? You know what I mean? Hey, light up my nucleus, will you please? That's kind of what I'm looking for, because there's something about having a lit up nucleus accumbens that feels really, really good. Well, let's say it's this way. You know, there's one of the theories is that sexual obsessiveness is an anxiety disorder. What could that possibly mean? Okay, it means you get nervous, you're looking for discharge. You want to relieve the nervousness. One thing that all nervous animals do is they tend to organize. When an animal gets very nervous, it tries to organize. It tries to put things in place. It tries to find a safe place to be. Organizing means running something over and over again in your mind. You know, so you could think of somebody who's obsessive about checking a door and the locks and things like that. It's like you could just tell they're under threat, so they got to lock, go over, wash their hands time. Well, sexual obsessiveness is like that too. So you're thinking, 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 and as long as you're thinking, you're not feeling as anxious. And then the obsession turns into a behavior, which could be anything from self-satisfaction to having sex on the outside, and there's a release. Now there's a release from that anxiety for a moment or two. And if it's even for a moment or two, we've learned from laboratory rats that if you give them just a moment of satisfaction, they're going to go and go for that, even though when they are done with it, it's going to come back and they're going to have the same anxiety. So is sexual obsession a form of anxiety that just manifests sexually, that looks for release in the form of you thinking about one thing or another continuously? That's a question. And one of the ways I want to back into the answer to that question is to look at the medical treatment of it, because that's very, very interesting. Because before psychiatry came along, all we had was talk therapy and the church. Talk to your pastor. You know, the great question is, the young boy go into the confessional every Sunday and say to the priest, "Dear Father, I masturbated." They never talk about that. You leave that part out. That's, you don't talk to your priest about it. So who do you talk to about it? You talk to your friends about it. Or you go find a therapist, and the therapist tells you that if you keep it up, you're going to go blind. None of those treatments necessarily worked, but then suddenly, when you feel yourself a mature man who can't go to work because all he thinks about is some sexual fantasy, you know, kissing somebody's shoes or something like that, and he goes to a doctor like Kent, and he says, help me, doc. I can't get shoes off my mind. What do I do?
Well, again, the the various treatments that we have, the various medications, which usually goes along with psychotherapy to go into sort of what may be causing some of the unpleasant obsessive sexual thoughts and behaviors that are causing problems, are medications that sometimes affect the endocrine system and things that would lower testosterone. That happens in some very extreme cases. More likely, what we do is we try to affect the areas of the brain that are involved with the judgment and the executive decisions to act sexually. And some of the medications, the antidepressants involving serotonin and dopamine, are sometimes helpful to limit the obsessional sort of preoccupation with sexual thoughts, as well as trying to get rid of any underlying anxiety and depression that may be fueling a wish to get relief from anxiety and depression. If part of sexuality has that function of just as a distraction or a way to get relief from a chronic feeling of being blue or being anxious. And so that if you're helping people feel less blue and anxious, there's less of a need to have some kind of thought or behavior to distract yourself from that, as well as the way that dopamine and serotonin can help people with their impulses.
Well, you know, it's fascinating, Ken. Thank you, because there's a thought there. So the antidepressants work in a couple of different ways. There's a lot of people I know who take Prozac, and they say, hey, I have no sexual interest anymore. I can't even get an erection. The drug has killed me. So we know that it lowers something, whether it's testosterone or whatever it is, or the internal Viagra, whatever it is that it touches. It touches the wrong thing, and they complain about it. But meanwhile, if you're trying to treat somebody who's got an overactive one, who's so overactive sexually, the very same drug may return them to normalcy as opposed to getting them to be asexual. But it's kind of a try it out, right? And see how it works. Is that the way it works with the antidepressants?
Absolutely.
Because you really, it's not, oh, this is perfect for that.
Yeah, again, that category of drug, Prozac, really involves serotonin, and many of those drugs like Prozac, Paxil, Zoloft, Lexapro, Celexa, they all have that component to it, which it seems via the serotonin to decrease libido, to decrease sexual desire, which, as Armand said, can be a problem if somebody feels like they have a normal, healthy sexual desire and relationship and it interferes with that. It can be a real problem with these medications. But for somebody who's troubled by sexual obsessiveness causing pain in their life, it can actually cause some release and sort of comfort to not be bothered and troubled by these thoughts if it's causing them trouble.
You know, I want to include in this mix, there are many people who would say they want sex, but they really want is oxytocin and bonding. And they're dying for the bonding. I've got to see that man because I got to hold him in my arms. Because if I don't hold him in my arms, I don't feel whole. I don't feel safe. And the only way to get that man to hold me in his arms is through sex. So what I think about is how I would be sexually desirable to him so that he will hold me in his arms. Or the opposite, he feels the same way. How do I satisfy her sexually so she'll be bonded with me? And I thought yesterday as we explored it that there may be an oxytocin addiction. Mm-hmm. That could be that one where you've just got to have it. And so many people I live in miserable relationships because all they care about is the bonding. I hate my husband. He does all kinds of things. He cheats on me. He lies to me. But at night, I have to hold him at night. That kind of thing.
Yes, may I ask you a question, Kent? When you're distinguishing an anxiety disorder, and what about the libido? What about the sexual drive? How can we distinguish whether something is a sexual obsession or whether someone has a heightened sexual drive? Or, of course, we have that bonding. So we have a couple of things going on. And how do you, as a psychiatrist, how do you know how to appropriately diagnose that?
Well, again, as we're saying, it's only a problem if it causes the person a problem. So that we're trying to say that one shouldn't have shame, or the society or people shouldn't have judgment or shame if they spend a lot of time with sexual thoughts and it gives them joy and pleasure and it makes their life satisfactory and adds to it the way jazz adds to my life, then God bless you. You know, that's fine. It's only when it's causing troubles, it's distracting, or it's causing problems in interpersonal relationships because you're in a relationship where there's an agreement that there shouldn't be sexual, you know, acting out in, or sexual behavior outside a relationship, then that becomes problematic within loving relationships. And there, the inability to know the cause, the problems and the difficulties that could come from these feelings and actions and unable to stop would certainly put it in the realm of something that's not healthy and something that's causing destructiveness in people's life.
Thank you, Kent. I just wanted to thank you for clarifying that, because I think it's important for us to understand that, because in the literature it shows the rise of suicide among adolescents, which of course has that sexual obsessiveness when, as a teenager, people become confused, mm-hmm. they don't know who to speak to, and they can't distinguish what you just so clearly was able to say and define that. So I think that's another piece of information that is important to note.
Interesting thing about suicide. I always see suicide not as I'm trying to kill myself, but I'm trying to kill the feeling that I have that I hate so much. I don't like feeling this way, so I'm going to jump off a bridge to stop the feeling.
Yeah.
It's not to end my life. I just want to end the feeling. So I think suicide very often is just an attempt to end an agitated feeling, not just even just pure depression. You got to have almost agitation with the depression to do it, because depressed, you just lay down, turn into a heap and go to sleep. But with an agitated depression or with anxiety like you're talking about, you don't know how to stop it. Bat yourself over the head. You know what I mean? Hit yourself. Punch yourself. Try to get into fights. Do something, you know, and it doesn't work. Take your medications. It doesn't work. The bridge becomes appealing. And for young adolescents as opposed to old adolescents, for adolescents, they're lost with this. They don't know what to do with it. Who could they talk to about it? Talk to your parents about it. You know, you feel so evil and shameful for everything you feel. So rather than that, what they would do is they would say, let me put an end to this. And it's not, I'm going to end my life. I'm just going to end the pain.
But, you know, it's interesting that adolescence, to really put a positive spin on adolescence that I know causes many parents lots of headache and hair loss, that a lot of what we see with adolescents and their sexual behavior, which seems kind of reckless and seems to not have a lot of judgment attached to it, that seems to be related to taking a lot of risks, that seems to put my relationship with my peers more important than my relationship with my parents. There's a feeling, and there's new studies that show all of this is evolutionary, very adaptive. That it's actually a very positive thing for adolescents to take risks. This is part of what they need to do. They need to leave the house and need the comfort and safety of mom and dad. And within that, you know, some of that is sexual and substance and partying and stuff like that. But part of that is probably healthy risk-taking that's probably adaptive to deal with leaving the comfort of home. And clearly, adolescents judging and honoring peers' opinions more than parents is absolutely adaptive, because they are going to be their life, not their parents. You know, so it's a good thing that they're valuing the judgments and the opinions of peers more than parents and teachers in some ways. It's adaptive to them. It's evolutionarily adaptive.
Well, it is. And if you think about the nature of anxiety and why we put anxiety in there in the first place. I mean, why did the great chemist in the sky decide to make you anxious? So that you'd move, right? So that you do things, so you get things done. Then it's going to find out, we're going to make you anxious, and it's going to make you strive to go out on your own and run away. How are we going to make you anxious? And people have it in different ways. Sports can become a focus. But sex is such an easy focus because it's all in your brain. You know, it's all in your mind, and you could think about it all the time, you know, sex. Or love, which is just as easy, right? And you just obsess about it all the time. This is Armand DeMille with Linda Vanella and Dr. Kent Robert Shaw. We're talking about obsessive disorders, but obsessive sexuality. We're going to talk a little about the compulsive part of it. Remember, an obsession is a thought that recurs and persists despite your efforts to ignore or confront them. And people with these disorders frequently perform tasks to seek relief from the obsession-related anxiety, and those tasks are called compulsions. So the obsession is what's in your mind, the compulsion is what you do. Some people have compulsions with no obsessions. Some people have obsessions with no compulsions. But some people have obsessions with compulsions, and some people have not enough money for lunch. Hey, so we're going to take your calls today, too. 212-209-2900. We're going to be taking your calls, but not right away. First, we're going to be just going a little further on what compulsions are. So let's talk about the sexual obsessions that involve intrusive thoughts. Kissing, touching, fondling, sex of all forms, intercourse, rape is a fantasy, incest is a fantasy, all of this in the mind. I mean, and we make it all evil. We make it all that whatever it is you're thinking about, buddy, don't think about it because it's dirty and it's bad. And I may think the same thing, but you're not allowed to think about it. I may be a preacher who thinks these very same thoughts, but I don't want you to think it, and I especially don't want you to get away with it. Because there is nothing that people hate more than seeing somebody who lives a free sexual life. We have words that we use, you know, that mean you're dirty, you know. We have bad words for people who act out and live out sexually. But that may be what they're meant to do. Maybe they're the ones who got injected with the thought, you know, go spill your seed everywhere or spread your eggs everywhere and have as many babies as you could have. And that's your job, and that's all you're supposed to do. Nothing else. Go sire the nation. Or madam the nation, whatever you do. So it seems to me that what we're doing is, by our judgments, we're trying to compress everything and say this evil isn't worth talking about. But we have to go back to what Ken said. 90% of the internet is dedicated to allowing somebody to having these thoughts, whether it be about love or about sex, but it's about obsessions, including shopping at Amazon. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, a little music, and then we'll continue our discussion. Thank you. This is Armand DeMille with you with a positive mind. Bella Fleck and the Flecktones. Sex in a Pan. Hey, this is Armand DeMille with you with the positive mind. Dr. Kent Robert Shaw, Linda Vanella, Booker Irvin here in the studio with us. Here's what happens to you as a parent, right? You have a daughter. Now, all three of you have daughters. I know this for a fact. Your daughter has an emerging sexuality, right? Well, yours doesn't yet, Kent, right? It's just a little too early.
I don't know about that.
What do you mean you
don't
know?
You may get into that. Who knows? You know,
may get into, right.
Yeah, Sigmund Freud and other people thought that we're sexual creatures throughout our whole lives.
Okay, but here's my question. Your daughter becomes sexual, starts wearing very short skirts, goes around flirting, talking to the boys, smoking pot, stuff like that, right? And then this is your daughter, and she's 15. What do you, as a parent, feel? Do you say, well, whatever the kid's got to do, the kid's got to do? Now, I know I've got two ideal parents here. Because I got Booker here, too. He's not ideal. Booker, come on, give him your philosophy. He's got a 16-year-old daughter who loves him very much. What's your philosophy as soon as your daughter becomes trapped by the boys? What are you going
to
do?
I want her to enjoy life as much as she can. I only ask that she does good in school so she has a future to look forward to. That's the only thing I want her to do.
I want her to have all the adventures, all the fun, whatever.
But what about your baseball bat?
I got that for boyfriends that don't respect her.
Oh, okay. Okay. What about you, Linda? Is it natural to want to inhibit your child's sexuality? I think you guys are going to make believe you're saints. You know, it's disgusting.
No.
Tell me some truth.
No, I'm going to give you truth, Armand. I have three sons and a daughter, and by far, my fear was heightened with my daughter as compared to with my boys. My boys, I was much more comfortable with them exploring and encouraging and just be safe and enjoy yourself. With my daughter at age 10, I find myself wanting to keep her safe, being selective about her girlfriends and her boyfriends, knowing that she was curious, watching her a little bit more closely. And she reminds me of this every day.
So this is like she's one of the witches of Salem. You have to be careful. You with the, you know, you non-penile person, you're dangerous.
Well, not necessarily dangerous, but maybe I didn't feel that she was as safe as I felt confident with my boys. So, yes, there was a difference of the way that I dealt with it.
And how about your sons? I'm sorry, I know you still call them boys, even though they're in their 40s. How about your son's sexuality? Was it all okay with you the entire time? Whatever they wanted to do, hanging from the chandeliers?
No, I tried my best to instill whatever values I felt, and one of them primarily was to keep themselves safe. At the time, it was the time of AIDS when I was raising the boys, so they were very alerted both in the school, in the community. So a lot of it was kind of held, you know, as far as being safe, but I felt that it might interfere with their normal relationships, and, you know, sexuality shouldn't just be something that's mechanical and safe, but should be more of a relationship.
So it wasn't prohibitive, yes. It was cautious.
Cautious.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, I understand. Kent, what do you think the plan is?
Well, I think that we're talking about partly the medical reality of sexual diseases, right? So that's not coming from a moralistic or judgmental place. That's just the truth about nature. So that I think that aspect of safety is something that's very important to be teased out of sex and having what hopefully should be a healthy and positive relationship with sexuality, because I think that there are, you know...
Well, wait a minute. Why does it have to be healthy and positive? Why can't a teenager just have oral sex, you know, at whim? Why does it have to be healthy? Why can't it just be whatever they decide to do?
Who says oral sex isn't healthy and positive?
No, because I'm thinking about what we always try to do as parents, is we talk about how you've got to have a good relationship, you know? What if it's just sex because it gets me off? Sex because it relaxes me.
Well, may I
sex because it makes him hug me.
May I say, Armand, I felt that, yes, oral sex became very much a part of when I was raising my children because of what was going on politically. And so they were really, I think, introduced rather young, and so that it did look as though it was very positive and very acceptable. So I then
saw... I'm sorry, that was a little too vague.
I'm sorry.
Because of the political influence of where you were born.
Yes. Well, no, because
your politicians
of
the
times that my children were in their teens. They did come to see oral sex as not being sex itself. So therefore, but they also saw that there was a lot of viruses. As Kent mentioned, of course, that whole STD, sexual transmitted diseases, became very prominent among their friends. So they started developing these herpes infections and many of them in their mouth. So it became part of an educational in the home when I was raising my children that was a part of, yes, be careful, be cautious, have fun, enjoy yourself, but just be have information, be knowledgeable.
Now, in the Sicilian family, my part of the family that's Sicilian, they said it kind of different. You know? If a girl had sex, they would have stoned her to death. I mean, or they would have killed the man. Just it's his fault because he did it, you know? And it was in a lot of the cultures that a lot of people grew up in were very repressive. Hey, you know, I'd like to make sure today we get a couple of calls at 212-209-2900. That's 212-209-2900. So there are compulsions that happen as a result of these sexual thoughts that drive you into behaviors that sometimes just make you feel besides yourself. We are trying to say it's understandable that a lot of it is chemical. A lot of it is organic. Some of it is symbolic. You know, why do you happen to like somebody who wears the same shoes that your mother does? You know, some of it is, you know, you only like older men. It may be symbolic, but it's also just the form that it's playing out, because if you didn't have the hyperarousal, it might not even take that form at all. But who knows? The one thing I know is the puritanical approach to it leaves you nothing but a dead turkey. 212-209-2900. Let's take one of your calls. This is Armand DeMille. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
Hi, you can hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, what I was going to say is I'm 56 years old, and I developed a sexual feeling very early, but I think sex is something always, it's like a renewable energy. Without it, you cannot do it. But when you teach a child, a teenage, to have oral sex, I think that this is a wrong information, wrong message. It has to start much later at developed age when they can comprehend what sex is and enjoy it to the fullest extent. Because sex is like money. It gives you energy. Without it, people are doomed. But in Middle East, if you have a sex outside your marriage, they will behave you. There are a lot of different issues about the sex. But this is something, it's like a renewable energy, never runs out. You can have sex when you're very old. I think it's beautiful. But what happens in Islam, you cannot do it. I think we should condemn Islam for doing it, behaving women for having sex outside their marriage.
So did it in any way hurt you when you were younger?
No, I had sex when I was even, like sexual feeling very early, but I think that...
But were you inhibited? Did they tell you you shouldn't be moving on them, that you shouldn't be...
No, nobody did it to me, but I see that if you have sex outside your marriage, you'll be hated, you'll be slashed, you'll be publicly humiliated.
So what did you do? What did you do with your sexual feelings? Did you hide them under the burqa? What did you do?
No. I don't hide nothing under the burqa. I do what I need to do, but my point is for the other woman. They should exploit their feelings to the fullest extent as much as they can, because without that, they age very fast. To prevent aging in the woman, you need to feed yourself with the natural fountain of sex that comes from within. And that's related to the physiology and the psychology of the person who has it.
So it seems like they're very lucky to have you around when they're being told so differently by so many people around them, especially in Islam, right?
I mean, they're lucky. I'm a writer. I write. about all kinds of feelings that people should have, and I'm writing a book that I wish to take you to WPAI one day.
Send it to me.
Yes, yes. I think that everybody, man or woman, after they have finished a certain part of their goal at early age, they should start having a sexual life inside and outside their marriage, both.
Huh.
Not inside, because you cannot eat steak every day. You cannot eat fish every day. If you do, you die. You know, die meaning that psychologically, you know, or mentally. But you have to have a different kind of environment to enrich yourself. So you have to have a sex outside your marriage, because marriage sex and outside the marriage sex is two different things. But outside the marriage sex is more of a enriching yourself. And inside the marriage is like feeding yourself 3 times a day because you're hungry. It's like you have to do it. But outside the marriage, it's a beauty. It's a jewelry. It cannot compare with the sex that's inside the marriage. Outside the marriage also enrich your life, your feelings, your psychology. It gives you more energy.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, it could be that, or you could be married to somebody that just turns you on so much that, you know, you're exhausted.
What? If you're married, you are doomed to enjoy good sexual life outside your bed. You have to have somebody else.
That should be the name of your book. If you're married, you're doomed.
I like it.
Hey, listen, thank you very much for calling in, and thank you for your risk taking.
Okay, thanks.
Bye. 212-209. That's pretty outspoken. Well, we've had a couple of people on the show who have said the same thing on the program, who have said the same thing. Stop expecting people to be monogamous, because there's a certain thing you keep getting the punishment of that. Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead. Yes.
Hello?
Yes, I can hear you.
Yeah, I've been in a lot of relationships, and lately I've been trying not to just have random sex, but it seems like there's times where I can't stop myself from doing that.
Now, give me the conditions under which you find yourself having random sex. Are you usually stoned when you do it? Are you usually drinking?
No.
What is the thing that brings you there? I mean, are you at home and you're lonely and you say, hey, there's that woman that lives down the hall? What kind of gets you there? What connection can you make between doing what you don't want to do? I mean, it's only your judgment, not mine. But you're saying to yourself, I don't want to have random sex anymore. I want to be able to have a better relationship. And then what?
Well, I mean, I'm not going out and meeting random people. I mean, it's people I have friendships with and people I develop friendships with. And it never really goes past that for me. And
so what are the conditions under which you say to yourself, I don't want to do it, but I'm going to do it anyway?
I mean, I just get the urge, and I just go with it.
Okay, you know, you've never associated the urge with anything, like coffee, or being rejected, or getting sad, or being lonely?
No, not really.
Okay, I mean, so there's a thought for you. See, there's a thing called the cognitive behavioral approach to dealing with this, and it looks for associations. When you're doing something you don't like doing, like let's say a person overeats, they ask the person, what were you feeling right before you overate? What were you feeling right before you took the drug? Since it's something you don't want to do, not that I'm judging it, the question would be to examine what is associated to it. Did you get nervous right beforehand? Were you lonely right beforehand? Did you think about your mother right beforehand? And look for that association. It'll help you have a little more control.
Okay.
And so you can have what you want, okay? Because there's this one other thing that happens with men like you, which is the avoidance of any real intimacy. And that means because there's something inside you that believes you're going to strangle if you're caught in one place. See?
Right.
And so this behavior keeps you from that. Now, here's the bottom line of it. Maybe you're not meant to have an intimate relationship. Maybe you're fine the way you are. Maybe you're a guy who just has got to have a nice bunch of casual relationships. And somewhere down the line, 10, 15 years from now, your hormones will settle down and you'll look around and say, you know, it would be nice to share the sunlight. And that'll happen over time. But if you want to speed it up, look for the associations, look for the connections.
Okay.
You sound like a fine person. Thank you very much for calling in.
Thank you.
212-209-2900. This is Armand DeMille. Let's take another call. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
Dr. Armand. Yes.
You got me.
And to your guests, thank you for taking my call. You know, I just thought that something philosophically I had reflected on while I'm listening, trying to be attentive to it, that there is a mutual complementarity, okay, between the two people and the two sexes and so on, and that we often lose that or don't realize that we disrespect each other, and that there is the integrity of the whole person, the female and the male, or however you want to see each other. That's all.
Well, that's pretty fabulous, but how about the lack of integrity? How about you go to a bar, you meet somebody who's lonely and lushed, and you find somebody, and you're lonely yourself, and there's no real compliment, you know, it's just you take somebody, you kind of drag them off to bed, mm-hmm. and you have sex with them, and you forget them in the morning. Is that evil? Is that
no.
bad?
No, I don't think so, but that's just part of our human nature. That's all I see it as.
Let me ask you a big question. We know that if an older man has sex with a younger woman, like a young woman in her teens, they take that man, they lock him up, they castrate him, throw the key away, right? We know that if an older woman has sex with a young man in his teens, we know they're going to lock up the guy and throw it away. Now, the young woman can purely claim that she was damaged by it, that there was something happened to her as a result of it, may not get over it. But do you think you, as a young man, at age 12, 13, 15, if you had somebody who wanted to have sex with you, who was 25, 30 years old, I don't know if it really happened to you, but if you had that, do you think you would have been damaged by it?
I don't think so.
No man does.
No. Yeah.
Okay, now it's a funny thing.
That would just be another thing for the man experience.
Right. It's a funny thing. We want to perceive young men as abused. But for the young man, no men I know have said, oh yeah, that would have damaged me terribly.
Yeah. Well, maybe they're physically stronger, and it's a cultural thing too.
Good. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thanks
for calling in. Sure.
Come on. You're wonderful, man.
Thank you. Thank you, guy. 212-209-2900. Kent, just that same question. It's a dangerous question. I'm asking, you know, what do you think that young men would say?
Yeah, I think that that most men, certainly 15, 16, let's go there. I'll start there in a safer before I go to the third rail of 12 years old. Let's start 15, 16. I would think most 15 and 16-year-olds, your 22-year-old teacher, substitute teacher, certainly would not say
or babysitter. No. You know, or a babysitter who's, you know, playing with you. I mean, they would not only not say no.
You would say yes.
They not only say yes, but they'd talk to their friends about it and they'd have a party. Right?
Yeah.
But yet, if they were caught, they would persecute the elder woman. But now it changes if the elder person is a man. See? Now when it gets into the realm of homosexuality, now more persecution comes out for everybody. So it's the reason I bring this up is it's so silly the way we perceive everything. I don't know what's right. I don't know what's wrong. But I do know a lot of what we think is wrong and bad and evil is something that comes from this puritanical, I got to have a turkey kind of thinking. 212-209-2900. One more call. Let's grab one. Hi, you're on the air. This is Armand DeMille.
Is that me, Armin?
Yes, it is.
Oh, thank you. I listen to you all the time. You do put on a great show. I have an issue with sexuality with my wife. About 7 years ago, she became spiritual and devoted so much time to it. And apparently, after her awakening, she actually went out and started having sex with other people, putting ads like on Craigslist and totally shutting me out, and then when I became aware of it, like lying and denying, and I'm having a tough time with it.
Sure, sure. Now, have either of you seeked any professional help with this?
Yes, we went to, I started going myself, which I'm not usually that guy, but I was so confused.
Because
so
it sounds to
angry.
Me, since I only have a couple of minutes, I want to say something. How old was your wife when this started to happen?
In her early to mid-50s.
Yeah, that sounds like an early menopausal thing that takes place very often. And I've seen this happen with women, where suddenly they turn around and they've got to sow their wild oats. They got to get it out of the way. And it's a compulsion. And it's such a compulsion and such a drive that they can't do anything about it. Now, it's also very effectively treated with medication. You know, there are ways of kind of bringing it back when it happens. But it isn't because you're no good that she's cheating on you. She's being driven by something, like something inside her is driving her to this wild place where she can't honor the relationship with you. And somehow the two of you have got to meet the right treatment modality. Or even you, I think being in therapy alone doesn't make any sense. You just got to understand.
She thought it'd come for a little while, and then she said we reached a plateau.
I understand.
Climb out.
My heart goes out to you.
The therapist actually said that she felt that my wife doesn't have any trust in her, and that's why we're not getting anywhere with where we are.
Yeah. I wish I could do more with you. I have to get going. If you want to get in touch with me, I will discuss it with you further. I have some ideas around it. This is Armand DeMille. I'm sorry we have to go. Dr. Kent Robert Schwepp, thank you for being with us. Booker Irvin, thank you for being here. And Kent, thanks a lot.
Oh, my pleasure, always.
And Linda Vanella. If you want to get in touch with us, you go to thepositivemind.com and find us from there.
Sexy city, you broke the rules.